Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. American institutions are less trusted than ever before. Our society is deeply divided, and much of the world is in turmoil. The problem isn't religion, atheism, or ideology per se. Rather, the real culprit, and one that receives far too little attention in public discourse, is the widespread embrace by social activists of utopianism, a zealous belief in the perfectibility of society, which leads to acceptance of the dangerous notion that the ends are so important they justify virtually any means. How did we get to such a sorry state? My guest has some answers. Timothy S. Gagline, making his second appearance on Humanize, has written a timely and important new book entitled Stumbling Toward Utopia, How the 1960s Turned into a National Nightmare, and How We Can Revive the American Dream. Gagline is Vice President of External and Government Relations for Focus on the Family. Formerly, he served as a special assistant to President George W. Bush and as a deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. His extensive resume includes serving as a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and as a communications director for United States Senator Dan Coats of Indiana. Gagline has authored four books, a memoir, The Man in the Middle, Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era, the co-authored American Restoration, How Faith, Family, and Personal Sacrifice Can Heal Our Nation, Toward a More Perfect Union, The Moral and Cultural Case for Teaching the Great American Story, and now Stumbling Toward Utopia. Tim, welcome back to Humanize.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
You spent your entire career in public service and policy advocacy. Briefly, what interested you in those realms?
What interested me most was this overlay of politics, policy, the press, and above all, people. And I learned very early on as an intern for then U.S. Senator Dan Quayle, who went on to become the Vice President of the United States, and an intern for then Dan Coats of Indiana, who at that time was in the House of Representatives, and for Roger Mudd at NBC News here in Washington. I learned over those two summers, Wesley, that this was really a vocation. I love public policy. I love the ideas that comprise culture broadly defined. I love people. And of course, as a man of faith and as a conservative, it sort of comes together. I never could have imagined ever living even a year of my life in Washington, D.C. And so all these years later, it's difficult to believe that after 10 years in the Senate and nearly eight at the White House, and now almost 16 years at Focus on the Family, that vocation has really become something joyful and has given me a purview, frankly, and I say this with humility, but has given me a purview to really try to better understand the political class and the culture that ultimately gives us public policy and that political class as we think about it.
I noticed your books seem to have a common theme along those same directions. But let's get into the book, the current book. What is utopianism and why do you consider it such a threat?
You know, I was sitting on an airplane coming back from a speech in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I travel about a third of the time for Focus on the Family. And with pinpoint predictability. You know, if I'm speaking to a left-wing audience, right-wing audience, or non-ideological audience, with almost pinpoint predictability, when you get to the Q&A part, someone will say, how did we get into this mess? there was a woman in the audience in Tulsa who said, I sometimes think that progressives, you know, have a utopian vision of our country. And that stuck with me. And I was planning, you know, to answer this question, finally, how do we get into this mess? And on a stack of the world's smallest napkins on American Airlines, I began to scratch out an outline that helped to answer that woman's question, which in one form or the other had been asked over and over again. And I went back to Moore's very famous book on utopia. And I learned, Wesley, that if you want to answer the question, how did we get into this mess in America and in Western culture broadly, the answer is that progressives have a utopian view of mankind, that that it's the perfectibility of man, and that with the application of just enough social engineering in policy, in entertainment, in law, in the legal realm, in education, if we can just attain the right ballast of social engineering, progressives broadly believe that we will eventually get to the perfectibility of man. And I came to see that in the American experience, this all came together. It came to a head in the 1960s. Acid, smack, Woodstock. There is a lot going on in the 1960s.
What do you mean by, quote, this mess, close quote?
You know, I'm intrigued because that phrase comes up over and over again with people when they're trying to figure out how we got in 1960 from, for instance, 73% of all young Americans living with a married mother and father at home to 1980, where that number had dropped precipitously, you know, to just above 50%, to 2015, where that number goes well below 50%. And now in 2024, the numbers are even lower. Pat Moynihan in the 1960s, and I'll be very specific, 1965, Pat Moynihan, who went on to become a very highly regarded a U.S. senator, had a felicity of looking at complicated empirical data, Wesley, and he could find trends in that in those numbers that other people with the same sensibility simply did not have. Now, this is only 1965, fits right into the book, where Pat Moynihan found in 65, 25% of all Black people were born out of wedlock. In 1965, Wesley, Pat Moynihan called that, and I'm quoting him, a crisis. That number in America today is 73%. 73% of all Black Americans are born out of wedlock. 53% of all Hispanic Americans are born out of wedlock. 33% of all native-born whites are born out of wedlock. The majority of babies born to women in America, ages 30 and under, are born out of wedlock.
Let me interrupt you quick.
Please do.
I think it's important that people know that Moynihan was not a Bible Belt Republican. He was a Democrat from New York.
Absolutely.
And second, so they're born out of wedlock. Why is that a, quote, this mess?
You know, I'm thrilled that you asked that because I was asked that question on the road just this week. And I was asked this question not by a fellow Christian or a fellow conservative. I was asked this question by a secular progressive, by her own definition, by the way. You know, she's as blue as a blue summer sky. And I went back to her. I quoted not figures or empirical data from the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute. I went and quoted statistics to her from the Brookings Institution, you know, the most important center-left think tank in our nation. I have learned so much from Isabel Sawhill. So it doesn't matter whether you're left, right, or center. It doesn't matter ultimately whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian on the question you're asking about, which is why is it important for little people to be brought up in a natural nuclear family? And the answer is that the empirical data tells us, Wesley, by the way, it's not even close. The data tell us overwhelmingly that little people who are raised with a mother and a father in an intact home, they do better on every single calculus as measured by a successful life. They do better educationally. They do better in physical, mental, and emotional health. They do better professionally. They do better in forming their own families. It goes on and on. Almost any data set that is applied to a little person between birth and the age of 18 that come from an intact home do overwhelmingly better. And by the way, it's not just the child who does better. It is also the mother, father, and if there are siblings, the siblings who do better. You know, some would say that the natural nuclear family is the thing. And may I say, Wes, that supersedes Christianity. That's Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, etc. This is the success sequence. And it's important that we realize that the reason we got into this mess is that in the 1960s, we had a moral and social revolution that literally sought to destroy family, marriage, parenting, education as we knew it, governmental policy, the Constitution, the law and legal institutions of our country. It really goes on all the way down to popular entertainment. It's kind of an inverse reality. And, you know, the American Revolution turns out to be a fairly conservative revolution, but our French Revolution really was the 1960s.
Yeah, I have been, I don't know if you are aware of this, been saying quite a lot lately that the French Revolution is attacking the American Revolution.
Absolutely.
Which is what's going on now. So let's talk about the French Revolution.
Yes.
How was it different in kind nature and its goals from the American Revolution, which you called a conservative revolution?
Yeah, in fact, I was deeply influenced as a boy and as a young man in the writings of Russell Kirk. And I remember being at a lecture with Dr. Kirk, who suggested that the American Revolution was a conservative revolution. I thought to myself, do the words conservative and revolution go together? It turns out the American Revolution was never called the American Revolution in real time. It was called the Cause. And about one third of all Americans at that time were for the Cause. But about two-thirds were either for the British or they were indifferent. And yet the law, language, literature, the modicum of our Constitution is born of the heavy influence, not exclusively of the empire that America was seeking to defeat, but the law, the liberty traditions, Blackstone, the way that we really think of the greatness of the Constitution. We were inheritors of a Western tradition that gave us this remarkable document, the United States Constitution.
And it's fair to say, just because I want to move us along,
yes,
that the founders of the United States were not utopian. They worried about the imperfectibility of man, which is why they created rights to protect man from powerful government.
Well said. They baked into the DNA of the founding of America the imperfectibility of man. In fact, it's why they pushed all the power downward and outward. They did not want an accumulative power in a capital like Washington, D.C. They split up power. And by the way, they split up power because they understood that all men are fallen. And they wanted to make sure there was not too much power in the hands of the judiciary, not too much power in the hands of an executive, not too much power in a legislative branch. In one sense, the legislative branch really is supposed to be first among equals. That seems like yesterday's news in an era where our legislative branch is utterly sclerotic. But may I say, Wes, that is also a result of the 1960s, because At the turn of the 20th century, there are a handful of highly influential people who are extremely uncomfortable with the American experience. President Woodrow Wilson, who had been an academic and intellectual long before he was the governor of New Jersey and the president of the United States, he was very uncomfortable with the Constitution, very uncomfortable with the Declaration. He said that the country ought to be run by experts. Roger Baldwin, the founder of the ACLU, was a communist, and he was very much in opposition to the legal system as he understood it in the founding of the ACLU. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, the fountainhead of the sexual revolution of the 1960s. She was a racialist. She was a eugenicist. A progressive. All these people were progressive. John Dewey, very uncomfortable with American education, thought that we ought to social engineer the new citizen. And you know, Wes, these people are working at the turn of the 20th century, so it doesn't take long. By the time we get to 1965, 67, 68, 69, these ideas are churning, and they are the ones that power the progressive French-style revolution that you mentioned a moment ago. And by the way, the impact on our country was as dramatic as the impact of the French Revolution on Parisians and that great country.
So what were the supposed goals of the French Revolution, and what was the consequence of the belief in the perfectibility of man in France?
Yeah, well, the goal of the French Revolution was the end of the monarchy and the end of the church. But that to me is too simple. Yes, they beheaded monarchs. Yes, and yes, places like Notre Dame, were vandalized and they sought to destroy it. But it was much deeper. It was a societal cultural rage against leadership. Against prudence, the ultimate conservative, Edmund Burke, the Anglo Irish statesman who wrote his great lasting book on the Reflections on the French Revolution. He is the one who did a deep dive on the French Revolution, what was actually going on there, and what Burke said, and he was very definitive about this, was that ultimately, if the radical revolutionaries of the French Revolution succeeded, you would utterly destroy the country as they knew it. And frankly, by the time you get to Woodstock, by the time you get to the shootings at Kent State, Wesley, we're seeing all kinds of signs of the complete destruction, the wanton destruction of the country as we knew it.
The French Revolution, of course, led to the Terror, in which many of the revolutionaries themselves ended up getting their heads cut off, led to Napoleon, and I would submit led to the Bolshevik Revolution, the Cultural Revolution in China, and the deaths of tens of millions of people. What do you think about that?
I believe that is completely accurate. Of course, in its violence and terror, it would be difficult to compare the 1960s to the French Revolution. But it would not be difficult or unfair to talk about the moral and social revolution of the 60s in America and what actually resulted from it. In fact, I think you could draw a bright line, Wesley, say between 1968 and America before that and 1968 and America after that. The assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Bob Kennedy, the mayhem and shootings on American campuses, the burning down of substantial parts of major American cities. Really, it was a direct result of the kind of cauldron of violence, mayhem, and ultimately the kind of moral relativism and nihilism that was celebrated by the creators of American progressivism.
You know, I lived through the 1960s, and I exactly understand what you're saying. But we have to be clear here also that there were real evils in the United States before the 60s. For example, racism and Jim Crow. And there were movements to eradicate that, the civil rights movement and so forth. But the civil rights movement, it seems to me, was not utopian.
Correct.
And could you explain how the civil rights movement differed from some of the things you're talking about that led to, quote, this mess?
I'm very honored to ask that question, and I'm thrilled that you made that delineation. One of my great heroes as historian is the late Paul Johnson, and Paul made it very clear that he was a conservative, and so his purview of history came through that prism. Another friend was Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who, like me, had been a special assistant to President Kennedy, to President Bush. And I have learned a lot from Arthur and his writings. And both of these men, left and right, made it very clear that it's that prism through which they view and write about history. By the way, they are great historians, and I am a mere writer. But what I'm saying, Wes, and I think this is very important to say, is that I did not want to write an ideological screed. What I wanted to do is to take an honest look at the 1960s and 70s. And so, as you know, in the book, I say, despite the things that I think were nightmarish about the 60s, and I write about them at length and passionately, I also make it clear that I believe that there were excellent things happening and being incubated in the 60s. And as you know, I champion the civil rights movement. I champion the Apollo space program. I champion the seeds that began to give us the computer revolution. I believe that there were things about the 1960s, even amid the destruction, that were happening that were worthy and good. And there's a reason that I keep a portrait of Dr. King in my office. I believe very strongly that as conservatives, it's not about revolution. It is about reformation and restoration. And I think that we have to honestly look at this decade and say, it was a nightmare. And going into the 70s, that nightmare continued. And I think we have to honestly ask ourselves, what were the seeds of that nightmare?
And what role did the Great Depression play in this kind of movement toward deconstruction as opposed to reform?
You know, I'm really thrilled that you asked that as well, Wesley, because I think there are many direct connections. And one of them is that the generation that lived through the Great Depression, the crash, that lived through the New Deal and the rise of Franklin Roosevelt, and then, of course, the terrible cataclysm of World War II. You know, many of those men and women came back from war. They had lived through this terrible war. They had seen a lot of things. Many of them had traveled around the world. Many of them came back very seriously wounded, lost family members, lost friends. And they wanted to come back and to hit the reset button. They wanted to get on with their lives. Many of them wanted higher education. They wanted to be married and have families. And so not always, but often, they tried to make it better for their children. You know, they had lived through a very difficult time economically in the Great Depression and in World War II, quite frankly. And so I think that not all, but many of the children of the baby boom generation, were raised in homes where their parents were more eager to give and to give and to give. And people understood that with the World War II generation, something massive had happened in Western culture and definitively was going to give us something different on the other side of it. And boy, did we get it.
Yeah, you know, and I remember those days very well. And I remember my father actually saying to me that he had suffered enough for the both of us.
Yes.
My parents' generation, the greatest generation, were really intent on keeping us, their children, their beloved children, from going through the kind of travail that they experienced. And this is just Smith on culture. I think they overdid it. Mm-hmm. And they spoiled the baby boomers rotten. And there are consequences that flowed from that you write about in the book. But I think there's one other cataclysm that we need to mention that I think was the spark that lit the bomb, and that's Vietnam. Vietnam tore this country apart, and I remember believing in the government and believing in the honesty of the institutions and so forth. And then there were so many lies spewed by the government about Vietnam that many baby boomers lost faith. Could you address that for a second and tell me what you think of that theory?
I'd be honored to, and it's a substantial part of stumbling toward utopia, which is that progressives got us into Vietnam. John Kennedy began to seed that. And then, of course, after John Kennedy was murdered on that terrible day in Dallas, you have a new president, Lyndon Johnson. He was a great admirer of both Franklin Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt was a great admirer of LBJ, and both of them deeply influenced by Woodrow Wilson. And so, Wesley, it's important to say two massive things happen at the same time. Domestically, the so-called master of the Senate, Lyndon Johnson, rammed through the Great Society. And by the way, I was just in Detroit. I went back and read most of the major, I think maybe all of the major speeches of the Great Society, all the promises, all the rhetoric. People are honor bound to read these speeches from Lyndon Johnson. The Great Society was going to save the city, save the family, save education. And it goes on and on and on. And people had, great respect for the federal government. They, many of them knew that America had just won World War II. I mean, couldn't America do everything? And then on the second track, in addition to all the promises of the Great Society, all that rhetoric, then we have the accumulative effect of Robert McNamara, the boy wonder. He was thought by John Kennedy and thought by Lyndon Johnson to be the most important public servant they had ever known. They had full and complete trust in McNamara. And then the creation and the escalation of Vietnam, to the point where 60,000 Americans lost their lives. And when you come to Washington and you go to the Vietnam Memorial, you can hardly believe it. Well, less than 2 years after the Great Society on the domestic front, everybody who was measuring it knew what a debacle it was. And certainly on Vietnam, it was the end of LBJ's presidency. He was finished.
And I think it... couple of kids I grew up with are on that wall. I think what happened, this is my experience, so you tell me if I'm mistaken, that once you had Vietnam, once you had Kent State, and Kent State, for those who don't know, you had people my age, which were college age at the time, shooting as National Guardsmen, demonstrators who were my age at the time. It wasn't intended, but you had several students killed, and it totally shook my generation beyond anything I can describe. And that's when I think authority was lost, because there were mass demonstrations on the college campuses, and instead of making sure people, of course, had the right to demonstrate, but instead of punishing those who were violent and trying to shut down education, the administrators yielded. And once that yielding began, I don't think we ever actually turned back, to the point where today you see in the anti-Semitic demonstrations happening on many campuses, the yielding of administrators and the losing of control of their campuses.
Yes, I find it greatly ironic that John Dewey, with the background and the full support of the Rockefeller family, Columbia University, the University of Chicago, the mayhem on campuses, what would he say about this? He was one of its progenitors. He wanted the new citizen. There's a lot of bitter irony in that. My own alma mater, Indiana University, with the full support of Indiana University, I write at length about the sexual revolution and Alfred Kinsey. We will be internalizing the unethical and dare we say it, immoral research that went into all of the Kinsey studies. Masters and Johnson, again, strong support of America's foundations. I mean, as a result of the washing away and the installation of a moral relativism. You know, no definitive right and wrong, no definitive good and evil. The installation of nihilism. The new arts and humanities. We don't read Shakespeare to find pleasure from Shakespeare. We read Shakespeare to understand imperialism and colonialism and a new race war and the way that that the arts and humanities were completely reimagined in the 1960s. This all goes together. These really great research universities who fully invested themselves in the new thing. And now we're only in 2024. And look what we have. By the way, I know that anecdotes are not statistics, but I was on the Upper West Side just a few weeks ago in New York City. I was shocked and heartbroken, Wesley, to think that that as an American, I couldn't simply walk on that beautiful campus. It's all gated and locked up. And the anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. Protesters in the new think is the new way. This can be ascribed to directly ascribed to the radicalism of the 60s and 70s and what the people who created it wanted for our country.
Including, the hedonism that was sparked, I think, was a result of the nihilism. And I remember, again, I'm going back memory lane, the saying at the time was, if it feels good, do it. And the idea of virtue was eliminated.
I'm actually preoccupied with the direct connection between the so-called intellectuals. And you'll remember Paul Johnson said intellectuals are people who are far more interested in ideas than they are in people. That's an intellectual. I think that that's a pretty good working definition. I show and demonstrate in Stumbling Toward Utopia the direct connection between the idea creators, the idea generators, and the way that those ideas are incubated, baked into what becomes a culture in the United States. And I'll use one example. One example is that when Hugh Hefner created Playboy, which becomes the pace setter for the pornification of America, he directly and specifically thanks Alfred Kinsey. He thanks Kinsey for the ability to adopt those the kind of Kinsey worldview, and then to concretize it into the Playboy culture. And of course, Hugh Hefner does this in a way, to your point, Wesley, which is rooted in obfuscation and untruth. The so-called Playboy lifestyle is supposed to be suave and sophisticated. It's about great suits and about smoking and drinking and gambling and the high life, when in fact the reality is the exploitation of women and the abuse of women. And this is directly related and comes to fruition in this kind of utopian view that we well nigh should take more seriously as it relates to the creation of American fine arts, middlebrow culture, and popular culture. It's why I devote so much of the book to Norman Lear and the frontal assault on American television and movies.
I think even worse than Playboy was Cosmopolitan. Mm. What do you think?
I write about Cosmopolitan as well. Helen Gurley Brown was strongly encouraged to change Cosmopolitan magazine. This kind of highbrow, high view of culture, fashion, and style, and to refashion it into a kind of 20th century, the kind of feminist agenda, but which includes so much more than that. It is Cosmopolitan becomes the sexual revolution personified, and so in one sense, it is paradigmatic of the Playboy revolution as well. And then, of course, we come to the 21st century, where we're still dealing with all of these terrible ideas. And you realize that the sort of Cosmo life and the Playboy ideals, so-called, you talk about yesterday's news. Now we have the kind of Kinsey, Masters, Johnson, and frankly, those early eugenicists, the early pro-abortion, anti-nuclear family people, and you really understand that this is so much of what's going on.
And you now have teenagers literally with access to the hardest core porn possible. When I was a teenage boy, I mean, you tried to get a glimpse of Playboy, right? Which was very modest compared to what happens today, as I understand it. And as a consequence, you have kids with a very dysfunctional and distorted view of human sexuality.
I think that there is a reason that we have the lowest marriage and the lowest fertility rates in all of recorded American history. And it is directly related to the progressive vision of what those people wanted and want for the United States of America. And I think as I illustrate in Stumbling Toward Utopia, I show the direct lines between this frontal assault on the natural family and where we have ended up today. And what I further show is that all of those early progressive critics said this was a culture war, that it was a social war, etc. And many of the conservatives said, yeah, we have a gigantic difference in our worldviews, but ultimately, this is also going to have economic ramifications. And the Great Society is one very important example of that. We have spent $22 trillion fighting poverty, and poverty is worse today, Wesley, than it was the day that the Great Society was announced. So all of these lies, which have given to us the exchange of a great American culture for a culture of nothing.
And I think we need to be clear that utopianism isn't about reform.
Correct.
It's about destroying all that came before it, sowing salt on the earth, and then supposedly rebuilding a perfect new society in which that is deemed so important that anything is justified in its pursuit. Let's talk about some of the instigators of this. You bring up someone who most people probably have not heard of, Saul Alinsky.
Yes.
Who was Saul Alinsky, and then what are his 13 rules for radicals?
Saul Alinsky is probably the fountainhead and the most important single figure of the 1960s. In that his book Rules for Radical, which by the way was dedicated to Lucifer, to Satan. Rules for Radicals is the single handbook for the moral and social revolution of the 1960s. It is, by the way, a how-to book. Deeply influenced Barack Obama, deeply influenced Hillary Clinton, deeply influenced hundreds of thousands of people who became part of what we now know as the New Left. And there are 13 rules. I won't go through all of them this morning. But Wesley, there's one rule that I think directly relates to 2024. It's Rule 13. Because all of us, left, right, and center, have been in conversations where people have said, isn't it terrible how polarized we are?
Let me read Rule 13.
Please so do. If you have it, great. Yes.
Pick the target.
Yes.
Freeze it. Personalize it. And polarize it.
That's it. That is absolutely it. That to me is it, and I think this is very important to say in light of your question about Saul Alinsky. When all of us have found ourselves in these conversations, often with progressives saying, "Isn't it terrible how polarized we are?" It's important to say with a straight face, "No." That's what the progressives wanted. They purposely championed for an entire generation of young progressives the importance of targeting and polarization. And by the way, they knew that if they could create disharmony, a chasm between the generations, polarity, polarization, that they would end up with a new country. And that's precisely what they wanted.
And I think it's important to understand that that effort continues. It didn't end in the 60s and 70s. It kind of ebbed for a while, and now it is back in full force.
I couldn't agree more. And as you know, in my third book, Toward a More Perfect Union, I show the disparity of the kind of Alinsky think with the greatest farewell address and warning ever delivered by any U.S. president, and that is George Washington. Washington's farewell address will be an important speech 100 years from now. And what Washington says is that in a constitutional republic, do not let fracture, faction, partisanship, party loyalties, do not let that become the directive or the navigation system for a constitutional republic. Because once you emphasize disharmony, discordance into the body politic, Washington warns, you will end up ultimately with a country, a culture, and a civilization in a land intended to be loaded with freedoms and liberties. You will end up ultimately with something that you will come to deeply regret.
I often joke that the baby boom generation really blew it, but we did have the best music. And yet you criticize a lot of the music in your book. You criticize Woodstock, which I'd like to know why, and also, which I understand, the John Lennon song Imagine. Let's start with Woodstock.
Yeah, Woodstock, 1969. These are human beings wallowing in the mud. By the way, I feature, a photo, acid, $1, this is a celebration of the illegal drug culture. It's a celebration of so-called free love. The fact that Woodstock happened, the age of Aquarius, is kind of emblematic. Culturally, of what the progressives of that period wanted. It's the nadir, it's the low point. And some of it, not all of it, is powered, in my view, by a music which is remarkably irresponsible. And I think that is important. It's important to say that the song Imagine is really about no standards. It's a celebration of nihilism. It is a celebration, ultimately, of moral relativism. And although I don't write about it at length in this book, I'm writing it in my next book. I went back, Wesley. I live in a land of rap music, had never listened to it. And I listened to it, and then I went and actually got the lyrics. May I tell you, rap music is the anti-rock and roll. Rap music is powered by the following. Why did you abandon me? Why did you give me this kind of life? Why did you leave me with this kind of neighborhood? Who's my mother? Who's my father? Who am I related to? Rap music is a strong protest against the kind of musical aesthetic of, in part, songs like Imagine. I'm willing to say, of course, there's great music in the 60s. Of course there is, but not that song, in my view.
I like the music of Imagine. The lyrics basically say how wonderful it would be if we didn't have countries, if we didn't have religion,
right?
If we didn't actually believe in anything and we can all come together as one. But that's not how human nature works.
It's utopian.
Yes.
It's a great idea that cannot happen. Those of us who are Christians who believe that there's only been one perfect person, Jesus Christ, the God-man, and that any other attempt to create a great country on a foundation of nothingness and the perfectibility of man, this kind of gerbil on a wheel social engineering ultimately gets you to many of the places that need reform. And I want to say categorically, I am an inveterate optimist, because I spend a lot of time with the rising generation of young Americans. In my time for Focus on the Family, I travel about a third of the time, and I'm on a different college campus in the academic year every 10 days. I love this generation. They are not the 60s, 70s, or 80s. They are impatient for all the right things. They want something better. They want something different. They understand the hollowness of no standards. They want to be married. They want to have children. But frankly, Wesley, millions of them have not had any models in their own families or in their neighborhoods. I was in a neighborhood a few weeks ago, and a young man said to me, I don't know anyone who's married, you know? So my view is that we have to pay attention to what the surveys and the numbers say, because we need good empirical research. But I think we also need to get out into the field, meet these young people where they're at, really listen to what they are saying. And what they are saying and what they are articulating is something quite unlike Woodstock in the age of Aquarius.
Yeah, but you have millions of other young people who believe in the raw power of sex. And let's face it, that drives a lot of this, and have lost belief in faith. Those two things combined, seem to have, and you tell me, you're the expert here on this, have created a mental health crisis for young people. We see youth suicides. You know, hey, in my day, there were no such things as youth suicide. I never heard of any child or young person committing suicide while I was growing up. And now we have a circumstance where, what is it, a large percentage of young women believe they're actually young men.
Yes.
So I don't quite understand how we can say that we are in a better place today than we once were, but I think the drivers of that are loss of faith and the power of sex.
I would argue that the biggest issue facing the United States today is not the economy and is not the border, as important as those issues are. It is a spiritual crisis of the first order, a spiritual recession, if you will, powered by moral relativism and nihilism, which we've discussed at length, and which I discuss at length in Stumbling Toward Utopia. But what I say is the following, and this is, in my view, the reason for my optimism. I believe that there are already being planted seeds of regeneration and restoration in our culture. You mentioned the trans issue. During the Olympics, we saw a woman get boxed in the face. You don't have to be somebody who's conservative to say, I think that's not right. I think we are winning that issue. The overwhelming majority of Americans don't want boys and girls sports, and they don't want men in women's sports. We have large percentages now of school choice, charter schools, homeschooling. More than 4 million young people are now homeschooled. We have people who have never been to a school board meeting, who of a sudden are going to school board meetings. They're learning how curriculums are assembled. They're running and winning for the school board. And we have families, by the way, Wes, you can measure this, who are overwhelmingly choosing to leave bright blue states, not for the politics per se, but for the culture. You know, they perceive that it's in opposition to their broadly defined worldview. So things are happening in the country, and I think they are by and large things that will bring us to the moment of the possibility of regeneration. It's not going to look like the 1950s. It's not going to look like any other previous period. And we all have to be comfortable that, you know, that's ultimately the case.
I want to be respectful of your time. And so we're almost out of time, but I have to ask this question.
Please.
The criticism could be leveled, and you just addressed it at the end of your statement, that all you want to do is go back to the 50s, where women had to be housewives, and perhaps racism inhibited, in fact, it did inhibit certain sections of the population from advancing, where people had to live kind of a stultified life that you had to follow the rules. And there are millions of people who are thrilled, for example, gay people who are thrilled that they can now legally marry. We talk about, you know, I involve in assisted suicide. A lot of people think, well, I should have a right to die on my own terms. How are these enthusiasts of the current social milieu mistaken? And why? What would you say to them about that?
I think it is impossible to live through a moral and social revolution the size, scope, and depth of the 1960s and 70s, and to somehow think that a great country like the United States is going to come out on the other side and ever have the ability, you know, to say, well, that all happened, but let's go, you know, let's go back two or three generations. I don't believe that that's going to happen. And for many of the reasons that you outlined, I don't think it should. I think that that period of time and in the generation before, in the 40s and 50s, gave us the possibility of many better things in America. And there are things that I happen to think are good for the country. But what I also think is that great nations go through extremely difficult periods, and they come out and they make decisions about the way forward. And I believe strongly that if we want a better country, it's not going to happen because the social engineers of, say, Washington or Silicon Valley or Hollywood or Broadway, Wall Street, that they're going to do this kind of top-down restoration. I think it's going to come from the bottom up. In fact, Wesley, I think it's already happening. I think people are very involved now as never before, even more self-possessed of what is my church doing? What is my community doing? What is my neighborhood doing? What is my school doing? I like the local and regional emphasis that's happening in our time. And I believe that there are millions of people, literally millions of people, who want something better. They don't feel empowered right now, but they're doing very good things that we don't even know about or that we're only learning about that give us the possibility of restoration and leading toward the American dream. I think that people of goodwill, large numbers in our country, want something better.
I think there's also a danger that when it comes to the revolution that we've been describing, which is utopianism,
yes,
it is never enough. Once one hill has been taken, they're on to the next hill.
Mm-hmm.
And there never seems to be an end, no matter how extreme. And I worry, I mean, you say you're an inveterate optimist. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I'm less optimistic. I sense also exhaustion on the part of many people. They're saying, fine, do what you want, just leave me alone. The problem, of course, is the revolution does not leave you alone.
I'm glad you asked that for this reason. I think discouragement and despair is a sin. And I think it's a really unfortunate way to live because it negates hope. And I believe that hope objectively is a real thing. You know, I'm a Christian. And so I believe as a Christian that I am honored to live in this country. And it's important that I engage as a good citizen. I have duties and responsibilities as a citizen. And I have lots of friends who are not Christians, and they feel duties and obligations to engage as well. And they love their children just as much as I do. But I also believe that in a great nation, you don't have to agree on every single thing to want to move forward. And I think Benjamin Disraeli, the great prime minister of England, had a great idea in One Nation Conservatism, that whether you are the man who works in the rail system or you're the president of the Bank of England, that everybody equally has a role to play in a great nation. I believe that very strongly. I think that George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Ronald Reagan, just to name three, articulated that view, and it's one that I agree with.
I hear your clock. you write from we're almost done here, but you write from a political and socially conservative perspective. Can one be a political liberal and oppose utopianism?
Not only do I think that you can be a liberal and oppose utopianism, I believe that there are actually large numbers of American liberals and progressives who understand and actually are willing to speak and write about the gigantic mistakes of the 60s and 70s. And in fact, I have a number of friends who work in various parts of life who are confirmed progressives who actually have written, I think, more eloquently than I have about the reality of what the 60s and 70s did to the social and moral fabric of the United States. And I think that we're already seeing, if I may say, the fruits of this reconsideration. We are seeing excellent movies being made. We're seeing excellent television being made. We are hearing new versions of classical music, contemporary opera, music that has melody and harmony, and reading, if I may say, and writing poetry, which is really of the highest excellence. So I think that when you look a little deeper, that you find a number of progressives who may not agree on the biggest things that conservatives believe are the most important things, but they also are not rooted in a kind of regnant discord.
You call for a third revolution to restore America to its former greatness. I think you've just been discussing that.
Yes.
What would that entail in addition to anything you might have already mentioned?
Government will never make you a husband and wife fall in love again. Government will never tuck a child into bed at night. All the promises of government, I don't believe, most of them. We have to reemphasize the importance of where we're from. I love T.S. Eliot's view, about the centrality of home. We have to concentrate on our families, marriages, parenting, the defense of the innocent preborn. We have to think anew about the importance of religious liberty for people who are religious and people who aren't, and why that's good for everybody. Conscience rights. My friend Robbie George wrote a powerful book, Conscience and Its Enemies. And he shows that why it's important to confront the dogmas of what he calls liberal secularism. And I think that we are doing that in a better way, every day. We have a long way to go. We do indeed. But better days are ahead for our country. I really believe that.
So other than reading your book, which of course I would recommend, how can my listeners engage the issues that you've addressed?
I hope first and foremost that people would go to the Focus on the Family website, because the Focus on the Family website is a one-stop shop. It's the best resource in our nation for anybody who's having challenges, in marriage, family, parenting, the wide swath. And Focus on the Family is really an outstanding ministry and ministers to everybody.
But do people have to be Christian to?
They do not. They do not. Focus on the Family is a Christian ministry, but we reach out and help anybody who needs the help.
Well, you mentioned you're writing another book, so my last question is always, what next for Tim Gagline?
Yes. My fifth book is in outline form, and I'm writing about marriage, family, parenting. And what I'm doing is I'm coming from the perspective that we have to reintroduce these institutions, to people in our country and our culture. I'm motivated by George Orwell's remarkable observation that the first duty of an intelligent person is to restate the obvious. And I have found, Wes, in all of my travels, that I'm meeting large percentages of fellow Americans who really don't understand what marriage actually is. We live through a large culture of divorce. We live through a large culture of never marrieds. We live through a large culture of people, who have grown up where mother or father have only been an occasional presence in their lives. So what I'm eager to do is write about marriage. What is a marriage? I'm also eager to write about family. What is a family, and why is it a social good? Why does it serve the common good? And I and the importance and centrality of children, and why children are a great blessing, and why we need more children, and why the concept of the natural nuclear family serves our country in ways that are almost untold. My late great friend Phyllis Schlafly once said that the family is the original Department of Health and Human Services, and that its crash and breakdown and smash up is very expensive. And so I think it's important to show as well, not just why family, marriage, and parenting are social goods and serve the common good, but I think it's equally important to show the cost-benefit ratio to a great country of intact families that are functioning, and why it's good for everybody. So that's the book.
Well, you know, it's interesting in terms of what we were just discussing. As a kid, I only knew one friend whose parents were divorced. And now I think you might, as you said earlier, many people would have only one friend whose parents weren't divorced or who were living together as a married couple.
Correct. I was speaking at a Focus on the Family event in Pasadena, California, and I was speaking in this very large auditorium to a group of young people who were part of the Jackie Robinson program as part of inner city Los Angeles. And I finished my remarks and I said that my father is my best friend. You know, when I said that, you could almost snap your fingers with, you know, these young people kind of looking down at the floor as if I had said one of George Carlin's seven dirty words. You know, what did I say? And this young man said, Mr. Yeaglein, we agree with everything that you've said, but there's nobody here today, you know, who really knows their father or has a very good relationship with their father. And I was in a large cavernous room, and that haunted me. And I began to speak to these young people, and I realized it wasn't that they didn't love the concept of fatherhood or the concept of marriage or family. It's that in their young lives, they didn't know what I was speaking about. And so I'm reminded that this is replicated millions of times over and over and over again. And so with Orwell, we have to restate the obvious and go back and reintroduce these concepts and what it all means.
That's really tragic. Will you come back when your new book is published, please?
That I promise. And thank you so much for having me today. It was great fun.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.